27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Vice President Mike Pence makes his case for a second Trump term at Wednesday's Republican National Convention.
Let's reelect President Trump and Vice President Pence for four more years.
NBA players boycott their playoff games Wednesday in protest of racial injustice.
It's amazing why we keep loving this country, and this country does not love us back.
Also ahead, thousands evacuate as an extremely dangerous, life-threatening hurricane bears down on the U.S. Gulf Coast.
You're going to hear the word unsurvivable to describe the storm surge.
It's all on today's International Edition. Amid a pandemic, a dangerous hurricane, wildfires in California, and growing protests over racial injustice following the shooting of a black man by police Sunday, Republicans tried to paint a steady image of President Donald Trump and his leadership on the third night of the Republican National Convention. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem said the nation is in crisis in Democratic-led cities.
From Seattle and Portland to Washington and New York, Democrat-run cities across this country are being overrun by violent mobs. The violence is rampant. There's looting, chaos, destruction, and murder. People that can afford to flee have fled. But the people that can't, good, hardworking Americans, are left to fend for themselves.
Outgoing senior advisor Kellyanne Conway sung the praises of the Trump administration. AP White House correspondent Zeke Miller reports the Trump campaign has been highlighting women as it courts the female vote.
The president's steady erosion in support among female voters, particularly women out in the suburbs in some of these key battleground states. Those precipitous declines that he's seen over the course of his presidency, but that those only accelerated as the coronavirus pandemic hit. It's causing his campaign a lot of agita right now, and they're trying to find a way to get them back to staunch some of the bleeding and get some of those voters back into the fold.
But he says the campaign is also using the convention to cast a wide net.
They are not trying to find or win over converts to the Trump cause. What they are trying to do is to take everybody who may like Donald Trump but may not love him, or loves Donald Trump but may not vote, and make sure they all come out and vote.
Vice President Mike Pence closed out the convention from Baltimore's Fort McHenry, where an 1814 battle inspired the national anthem. Adding still another controversial element, late Wednesday, the NBA, National Basketball Association, canceled its playoff games after the Milwaukee Bucks refused to take the court for their game following the shooting of 29-year-old black man Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Other teams followed suit. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
All three NBA playoff games scheduled for Wednesday were postponed as players chose to boycott in a statement against racial injustice. The Milwaukee Bucks, the top seed in the East, began the boycott when they didn't take the floor for their playoff game against the Orlando Magic. The Bucks are the NBA's only team in Wisconsin, where there have been protests in Kenosha all week after police shot Jacob Blake, a black man. Also postponed were the games between Houston and Oklahoma City and the Los Angeles Lakers and Portland. The NBA said all
senior intelligence and law enforcement officials spoke to reporters in a phone briefing on Wednesday to reassure voters there is, quote, no information to support claims that anyone will use mail-in ballots to manipulate the outcome of the upcoming election. President Trump has been repeatedly claiming mail-in ballots will lead to the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. Joining us for details on this briefing, VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden.
The briefing that they gave on Wednesday was the latest in a series of information they put out. And one of the questions that came up was about the mail-in voting, about the mail-in ballots, and the concerns that have been raised consistently, repeatedly by President Trump and some administration officials going back to May about how foreign adversaries or even the Democrats were trying to use mail-in ballots to rig the election. And what senior intelligence officials said was blatantly no information or intelligence to suggest that's happening. There's no information about nation-state actors. So we're talking about countries like Russia, China, Iran, which intelligence officials look at as the big three who have the potential to really try to impact an election. Nothing to suggest they're targeting mail-in balloting. And a senior FBI official says that they haven't seen anything either in terms of any domestic coordinated fraud broad effort to impact the election. So they shot that down. There are, though, still other concerns they have about election security, including worries about disinformation campaigns that are being waged actively by Russia, China, and Iran, and also by potential attacks on networks and computer systems that are going to be used in the election process, whether to tabulate the votes or just see who's on the voter rolls.
My understanding is one of the officials said that it would be very, very difficult to try to change the outcome of the election in mail-in voting, given how it's put together, given the system.
There are a number of senior officials on this call, and another senior FBI official said, and I'm going to quote here, the American public should rest assured that it is very difficult for a foreign adversary to meddle with actual vote counts. And this is something that intelligence and law enforcement officials and election security officials have been saying repeatedly going back to 2017 when the reports came out about what happened with the 2016 presidential election. The intelligence community came out and said the Russians meddled. But what did that mean? The big concern in 2016 was that the influence campaigns, the way that the Russians and perhaps others were using social media, Twitter, Facebook, other ways that people have of communicating to put out certain messages that might influence the way a person voted. There was evidence in 2016 that the Russians did scan and in some cases did penetrate state election voter roll databases and some other systems, but there's no indication that anything was changed. Looking over the last 4 years, a lot of effort has been put into shoring up and safeguarding those systems. And as a result, they say it'll be very difficult for anybody to penetrate those systems and to change the actual vote tallies. It'd be very difficult for somebody to go in and to change which candidate got more votes.
Did they mention anything about concerns by voters? There have been so many changes, or to slow down the mail itself, or is that a separate issue?
The intelligence officials, the law enforcement officials on this briefing did not address the concerns that have been raised by lawmakers and others about what's gone on with the U.S. postal system and how mail delivery is going to be affected or potentially impacted by changes that officials have made in terms of the mail delivery systems in the U.S. They did raise concerns, though, and this has been something that they've been talking about for a while, about the way that foreign adversaries like China, like Russia, like Iran, although Russia seems to be the most advanced at doing this with the information campaigns, specifically for the elections, using those concerns and using questions that people have to foster and to create more doubt, more confusion about what's going on. And that's been a concern all along. And so election security officials with the Department of Homeland Security have continually emphasized that the elections are safe, but a big part of this is going to be having informed voters, voters who know where to get trusted information, how to get information directly from election officials in their state or county, how to figure out where they vote, when they vote, and to understand that there could be a lot of information that's being put out there that they may be able to access on the internet or hear about from friends or even from family that may not be accurate, that may be part of a disinformation campaign. And so both those officials and intelligence officials say, look, U.S. voters have to be very careful. They have to be astute consumers of information and really check something out. If they see information that they think may not be right, check it against other sources. Don't trust one source and be aware that there is going to be an attempt to create confusion, especially in the period after the voting is all done, after the November 3rd election, because with all the mail-in ballots, it isn't likely that you're going to be able to say who actually won the election. There's not going to be a certified winner for days. They say it's not about election day. It's about the election period. And so they're also encouraging U.S. voters to have patience because unlike in the past, they may not know who the next president is until sometime after the voting is over.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden, thank you so much. Joe Biden has been out of public view during the Republican National Convention this week, but his running mate will be taking on President Trump later today, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Hours before the president's acceptance speech at the White House, Biden's campaign says Kamala Harris will blister him in a speech detailing what it calls his profound failure of leadership during the virus pandemic. In remarks here in Washington, Harris will highlight Biden's own proposals to control the virus and handle the economic fallout. It's billed as the former prosecutor's strongest condemnation of the president since joining the ticket, and another test of the argument she tried last summer during her own campaign, that she's ready to prosecute the case against the president. Sagar Magani, Washington.
More than a half million Gulf Coast residents fled inland from rapidly intensifying Hurricane Laura as hotels and shelters filled up quickly.
exacerbating the struggles of evacuees who had already lost jobs in the coronavirus pandemic. Leaders in Texas and Louisiana urged people in the expected path of the hurricane to move inland before it was too late. National Hurricane Center Director Ken Graham says Laura is an extremely dangerous hurricane that may not be survivable in some places.
About 180 miles, even 200 miles potentially. It's just a large storm. And then the hurricane force wind stretching out about 40 miles from the center. So still has some room to get stronger. But either way, you're going to see some big time catastrophic and life threatening impacts associated with Hurricane Laura.
The storm packing 225 kilometer per hour winds as it moved toward the Gulf Coast is expected to cause catastrophic damage to property along with widespread flooding. Hurricane Laura is also threatening crude oil and natural gas production along the Gulf Coast. More than 300 offshore facilities have been shut down and evacuated. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention narrowed the guidance for who should get tested for COVID-19, saying people who were exposed but not symptomatic may not need to be tested. That marks a reversal of the agency's previous position recommending testing for all close contacts of people diagnosed with COVID-19. The sudden change raised questions from some politicians and health experts about whether the decision was based on political pressure. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, in a virtual news conference Wednesday, said the Trump administration has resisted calls from scientists for more testing.
So now they're having the CDC, shame on them, as I say, shame on the commissioner of the FDA the other day for his misrepresentations. This all is being politicized, and yes, we will be investigating.
The reverse in recommendation follows an outcry from medical experts that led to Food and Drug Administration Chief Stephen Hahn this week apologizing for overstating the benefit of treating COVID-19 patients with convalescent plasma. Joining us to talk about all of this is Dr. Art Kaplan, bioethicist at New York University Langone Medical Center. Thank you for being with us. So how concerned are you that President Trump will potentially push through a COVID-19 vaccine before it's been fully vetted?
Well, I'm very worried that the pressure will absolutely come from Trump to get some good news about a vaccine before the November election. So it does seem to me that we can expect tremendous pressure on the FDA to approve less than complete data a vaccine. Now, the data might show some efficacy and might show some safety, but until you run the study to completion, you still really can't be sure that a vaccine is able to do either.
What would be your biggest concerns about bringing something like that out too soon?
So my specific concerns about approving any vaccine before a trial is finished, while something may look suggestive if you've run the trial halfway, it's not uncommon that side effects, dangerous things, or what looked like a bump in efficacy turns out to not hold until you get all the way done. So you're trying to do studies on big groups of people, 20, 30, 50,000 subjects. You've got a placebo group and people getting the active agent. And even if after 5,000 subjects, something seems to be giving a little bit more protection and doesn't seem to have side effects, you really can't tell if that's going to be true until you run really the whole study to the end. Because the more people you test in, the more likely it is that you may hit a side effect or what looked like it was protective was only protective for a few tiny number of people but didn't really give much protection overall. The other reason to be concerned is in approving a vaccine early, it doesn't mean that it's 95% effective in everybody. You can say this vaccine works 30% of the time, seems to be safe based on preliminary data. But getting a vaccine that works 30% of the time is not the solution to COVID. It's helpful if it holds up, but it still means everybody's got to wear a mask. It still means everybody's got to social distance. 30% effective vaccine is nice, but it's not going to end the pandemic anywhere. The last problem is as soon as you announce when it's a vaccine, that it's prematurely approved. It's one thing to take a medicine before it's fully approved if you're dying of cancer and you figure if this thing looks like it might help, I'll try try it. It's a different thing to be healthy and say they rushed the approval of the vaccine. A lot of people, polls are showing numbers like 40%, are not going to take it. They're just going to say, you know what? I feel fine. I'll keep wearing my mask. I'm not taking a vaccine that could wind up making me sick. So even if you approve it more quickly on limited evidence, what that says to a lot of people is that's not safe enough. I'm not using it.
The president also this past week came out with a big announcement about the convalescent plasma from people who've recovered from COVID. Is this some sort of breakthrough that can actually make a huge difference in treating COVID patients?
Convalescent plasma at present is absolutely not a giant breakthrough. We've given out a lot of it in the U.S. The Mayo Clinic alone has, I think, 70,000 patients in a sort of open-ended experiment, and they found a little bit of help for people. If you gave it within 3 days of finding the infection, that it slightly increased survival in that group of people who got convalescent plasma early. That is a tiny number of overall people with COVID who are very sick. Most people don't get even to the hospital to make it inside the three-day window. And the degree to which they saw improvement was tiny. It improved it by about a third in that small group of people who were dying, pretty high rate. It made it a little bit better for them. People have the impression, and Trump fueled this, and so did the FDA commissioner, that it would help everybody. A third of people would get better, but it's only a third of people do a little bit better in that little window of people who they got it to within 3 days.
My understanding is that it was already being used to some degree out there. So what exactly does this do, and are there dangers in it?
Convalescent plasma, meaning blood donated by people who were infected and seemed to survive okay, is rare. We don't have very much of it. There are people trying to use it, but it's very hard to get it. Overall, blood donation in this country and around the world is down because if people stay home, and that would include people who could be used as donors of this convalescent plasma. So it's a very short supply. So the question arises, what's different today after the FDA announcement and the president's pushing this forward as a breakthrough? Nothing. All that's happened is there's been an announcement that now the FDA thinks there's some value to doing this, and Trump saying it's a big breakthrough, but the numbers in terms of survival don't bear it out as a big breakthrough. It's a little bit helpful. So even if people ran around and now heard the president and said, I want you to give that to my family member or start pressuring doctors to use it, they probably can't get it. The other big problem is there are a bunch of unknowns still out there. For example, what's the best donor? Is it somebody who has a lot of immunity and was recently infected and recovered? Would it still work if you used somebody who'd been infected and recovered, but that was 2 months ago, but they still seem to have antibodies or immune molecules in their plasma? We don't know the answer to that. You're going to generate up all kinds of demand on a scarce resource, wasting it. So who's going to now jump into a study and say, I still want to sign up and be a subject so you can figure out who's the best donor and who does it really work for? Nobody. The president and the FDA just said it's a great breakthrough, so people are just going to say, give it to me.
Dr. Art Kaplan, bioethicist at NYU Langone Medical Center. The leaders of Iraq, Jordan, and Egypt held talks in the Jordanian capital Amman Tuesday to bolster economic and political ties amid ongoing regional tensions. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Qadhimi's visit to Jordan follows a trip to Washington last week and ongoing regional tensions between the United States and Iran. An Iranian government spokesman urged Qadhimi to visit Tehran as well. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
It was a highly touted summit, with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Qadhimi reaching out to potential allies Egypt and Jordan in what appeared to be a bid to loosen Iran's grip on Iraqi politics. Pro-Iranian militias have been accused of interfering in Iraqi government decisions and attacking protesters who oppose them. Arab media billed the meetings as an attempt to build an alliance of regional states that could eventually neutralize Iranian influence. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, however, was quick to invite Qadhimi to visit Tehran following Qadhimi's trip to Amman and the visit to Washington to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump. While in Washington, Qadhimi said during an interview with Iraqi TV that he was hoping to shore up regional alliances amid a climate of mutual respect. Kazemi, who took office in May, says that Iraq respects its neighbors and expects their respect in return. He says his visit to Jordan will help improve ties with Amman and further dialogue with Egypt in a bid to strengthen economic ties among the three countries and discuss regional developments. The three nations, he adds, may one day play a key role in the region. Iraqi, Jordanian, and Egyptian leaders have met twice before in recent years, once in September of 2019 on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, and in March of that year in Cairo. The Saudi-owned Ashark al-Awsat newspaper reported Tuesday that Iran was worried about a rapprochement among Egypt, Iraq, and Jordan, and about the rise of new regional alliances. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA that a potential new alliance among Iraq, Jordan, and Egypt could develop into a blocking line, as in football and rugby, to counter the growing malign influence of Iran. There are always those who will want to thwart this, he adds. According to Arab media, it is not immediately clear if Kazemi has the political clout to circumvent pro-Iranian Shiite leaders who are likely to oppose the move. Theodore Karasik is an analyst with Washington-based Gulf State Analytics. He tells VOA that one of the key issues the three leaders focused on was the recent peace deal between the United Arab Emirates and Israel. He also says the Israeli-Palestinian issue is front and center in the talks and that it is important to the three countries for their own internal reasons. Arab media reported that Saudi Arabia could eventually join Iraq, Jordan, and Egypt in a regional alliance. Several Arab analysts suggest that Prime Minister Kazemi may also be hoping to visit Saudi Arabia amid efforts to counterbalance relations with neighboring Iran. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. troops in Syria were wounded this week when a Russian military patrol slammed into their vehicle as Washington condemned the incident as a violation of safety protocols agreed with Moscow. Rights groups say Belarusian police have rounded up dozens of protesters heading home from peaceful demonstrations after days in which the authorities exercised comparative restraint toward the mass anti-government rallies that have continued for weeks. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And to AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. A new 4-meter-tall sculpture depicting three pioneers of women's fight for the right to vote in the United States has been unveiled in New York's Central Park. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the statue is the first on a famed literary walk to portray historical women.
The statue, called the Women's Rights Pioneer Monument, was unveiled officially Wednesday in Central Park. It depicts three pioneers of the women's suffrage movement, Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, together. Anthony stands holding a pamphlet in which the words, "Votes for Women," can be seen. Stanton and Truth are seated at a table. Stanton holds a pen as if she is taking notes, and Truth is leaning forward as if making a point in mid-sentence. The work by sculptor Meredith Bergman is part of a commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the constitutional amendment that guaranteed women the right to vote. It is the first statue in Central Park's so-called literary walk to depict actual historical women. Bergman told the Associated Press she was happy her work, like the women it depicts, is groundbreaking.
The monument stands in a row of statues, all of them of men. And in fact, all the historic statues in the park are monuments to men until now. That makes me feel incredibly happy for people who pass by, for visitors to the park, for the future.
The sculpture contains several visual references to the women's rights movement as well. Stanton's dress contains sunflowers because she wrote under the name Sunflower when writing for the Lily newspaper in Seneca Falls, New York. Susan B. Anthony wears a cameo with the Roman goddess of wisdom Minerva carved into it. Sojourner Truth wears a striped brocade jacket with laurel wreaths woven into it to signify victory. Bergman's original design was approved in 2018, but included only Anthony and Stanton. New York's Public Design Commission asked Bergman to change it and to add Sojourner Truth last October, giving her only 10 months to finish the revised work. Bergman, who also designed the Boston Women's Memorial featuring Abigail Adams, Phyllis Wheatley, and Lucy Stone, says the final statue cuts an impressive figure.
The figures are almost twice life size. Susan B. Anthony is 9 feet tall. The monument is 14 feet high, and it weighs a number of tons.
New Yorker Stephanie Roach attended the unveiling and said it was important to her to honor the suffragists.
Because I wanted to see the first women in Central Park in the form of a statue. I know that Alice in Wonderland and Mother Goose are here, but this is a historical moment in terms of having, you know, women that have fought for our right to vote and for things that matter to us.
13-year-old Jaya Shree of New York was also excited to see the monument.
It's really cool. I think it's going to inspire a lot of little girls to go out and do what they want to do. Yeah, it's really amazing.
The nonprofit Monumental Women sponsored the statue and is encouraging other municipalities to include more women and people of color in their public spaces. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
The cast of television's award-winning political drama The West Wing are getting back together for a special to promote voting in November's U.S. elections. Actor Martin Sheen, also a political activist in real life who played the liberal-leaning U.S. President Jed Bartlet on the NBC show, will reunite with the fictional White House staffers. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossing, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.